As Ulrike already said, I mean, these papers really nicely speak to each other, so makes a really nice panel and makes my job comparatively easy because I don't have to look for a common ground where there hardly is any common ground. I don't have to come up with a common ground, it's so obvious. So I will not discuss the two papers separately, but I will sort of, you know, discuss them together and link them to some broader issues, but we'll give then here and there some individual comments on the go. And as Ulrike said, these two papers are really complementary in a way that, I mean, you have a slightly different emphasis because he focuses on the failure, institutional deadlock, whatever, but it was the lack of progress, put it that way, or in regionalism in Africa, and then pointing to the disruptive role of the EU, whereas Ulrike starts more with sort of with the EU as, and so you could say your research design is a little bit more eye-centered and yours a little bit more egg-centered, but essentially you both arrive at the same conclusion that it is the EU who has a disruptive effect on regionalism in Africa, I would say. Well, Ulrike, you may not like this, but I mean, you have some, I mean, the interesting thing is that, and I wanted to say that a little bit later, but I mean, you have at least, you point to the variation. There is a differential impact of the EU, whereas, and that's one thing, Johannes, I think you should address. There is variation in this kind of effect, so it's not overall disruptive, but it's, before you venture into, you know, the variation you may observe and then think about how you can explain it, I think it's worthwhile flagging the fact that there is an apparent paradox in the EU claiming and I think also wanting to promote regionalism in Africa and other parts of the world, but then having a kind of disruptive effect. Well, most people would argue it doesn't have an effect at all, but you actually, I think, present some evidence which shows that the EU might actually have some negative, albeit unintended, effect on regionalism in Africa. And I think that's important to flag because there is a literature out there which discusses the impact of the EU and the US on regionalism in other parts of the world, and usually it's the US that's supposed to have a disruptive effect and an intentional disruptive effect, whereas the EU is seen and also likes to see itself as an actor that, you know, benevolently promotes regionalism in other parts of the world, and you clearly show that's not necessarily the case, and I think that's an important point to make. So I would encourage both of you to link your papers more explicitly to the literature out there on interregionalism and the role of the EU and the US in, well, not necessarily promoting, but in fact more spoiling attempts of regionalism in other parts of the world. And so the findings, I mean, I think, but then, you know, you have to become more nuanced and saying, okay, there might be a disruptive effect, but it clearly varies. The EU doesn't have the same effect with its economic partnership agreements on regionalism in Africa. And I think that comes out really nicely in your paper, Ulrike, where you say, you have actually three cases, if you want. You have the CARI forum. You don't really talk about that a lot, but you can say, well, they managed, even if they don't implement, but there is still variation. And in fact, you have, unlike Johannes, you have actually two dimensions of your dependent variable, if you want. One is, do these countries conclude an EPA? Yes, no, or sort of they an interim, right? So you have three different cases, whereas, and then the second question is, to what extent does the conclusion or non-conclusion of an EPA affect the coherence of these countries as a regional, let me call it regional organization, right? And that is closer to what you are interested, Johannes. And but it may be worthwhile to distinguish the two dimensions, and I'm not sure, I mean, you probably want to focus more on the first, but I think your first question then has significant implications for the coherence or the cohesiveness of these groupings. And so I think at least it is an intervening variable, and you may want to tease that out a little bit more systematically. So the question then is, how do you explain the kind of variation you find, and both of you use sort of use a comparison, and you, oh, by the way, sorry, I forgot to mention one thing apropos comparison. I was just reminded by the way, Johannes, you describe the role, and you too, by the way, you just describe the role of South Africa with this whole hub and spokes approach. This is very much what the US tries to do with NAFTA. And also, and I think, again, it might be worthwhile to sort of, you know, look beyond Africa, and I'll come back to that point. But this, again, this hub and spokes approach is very much sort of associated with the American approach of regionalism, and the US, again, juxtaposed with the EU, who doesn't do that, right? I'm not sure whether this is true, but at least that's the conventional wisdom. That's what the literature argues. Then the question is, how do you explain the variation you observe? And both of you use a kind of most similar systems design, arguing that the cases you compare are pretty similar, but then you find different outcomes. And the question is, how do you explain this? And both of you essentially end up, Johannes much more explicitly than Ulrike, in terms of the theoretical approaches used, but you both are at this point of the negotiation, the constellation, and power asymmetries within these constellations. I find that very compelling, but I would also encourage you to explore more explicitly alternative explanations, to make a little more room for your own explanation, because that is why it's so important, what is your dependent variable? Is it about, like you, in your case, Johannes, sort of the failure and success of regional integration or regionalism, and there is a big literature out there, and I'm not convinced that, I mean, that I'm very critical of the new regionalism literature and the Eurocentrism. It's true, but some of these theories actually would be able to provide some coherent explanation why there is so little regional integration in Africa, right? And if it's only because the context conditions that we have in Europe and sort of the Northern Hemisphere are not there in terms of functioning market economies and democratic systems, fair enough. But I mean, I think it, rather than simply repeating the kind of mantra of the new regionalism literature that everything is Eurocentric, and that's why by definition this cannot, these approaches cannot travel to other parts of the world, I think we have yet to see that, and the literature, even the new regionalism literature, has become a little bit more nuanced about that. If you see, if you look at the more recent publications of Alex Wallilek, for instance, they clearly advocate a sort of less stylized juxtaposition of the old and new regionalism approaches. So I think it is worthwhile looking at what the existing literature on regionalism, or I would still call it regional integration, or regional cooperation if you want, I don't care, but I mean, what they have to say, and then if you can make a convincing argument that I cannot account for that, then you can, you know, you make room for your own. And I mean, the situation structure approach, this is a nice way of getting to the problem, because I find your argument, Johannes, very convincing to say that, you know, the EU, if I understood it correctly, transforms a prisoner dilemma situation into a Rambo situation, although I wasn't quite clear who then in the end is the Rambo. Is it South Africa or is it the smaller countries? And somewhat you lost me here. So you want to be more explicit about who is the Rambo, because I mean, a Rambo game is almost impossible to solve with institutions. You know, if some actor has an exit option, the others have to compromise or the whole thing falls apart. So, but again, who is the Rambo here? But I found that very convincing. Again, I would encourage you to think about alternative explanations within, even within the paradigm or within the approach of the situation structure approach, because I'm not entirely sure whether this whole constellation doesn't resemble a coordination game with distributional conflict, so that it isn't more a battle of the sexes rather than a Rambo game. I don't want to bore you with these kind of game theory constellations, but I think it may be worthwhile to consider the option and discuss it, because a coordination game with distributional conflict is almost as hard to solve as a Rambo game. But there are institutional solutions. And since it's still unclear where, particularly where the, where was it SACU is going? You were a little bit more optimistic. It could well be, you know, if you can transform a Rambo game into a coordination game with distributional conflicts, then you have different institutional solutions to get out of that. A battle of the sexes, okay, one side, it's, you know, it's, it has to compromise, but still there are ways to compensate in those who sort of have to forgo, at least in the short run, benefits in order to, you know, reach the common goal in the long run. Okay, so I just want to, would like you to consider that. And then the other question, and that is a more important one, is what is the role of hegemonic powers in the region? Again, I'm not quite sure. You point yourself to the importance of a hegemon to solve prisoner dilemma situations. I mean, there are different ways how you can deal with these situational structures. One is you set up institutions, but setting up institutions in itself is a collective action problem. You need someone who sort of covers the cost of setting up these institutions, and that's usually the hegemon. And there's a huge literature also out there, particularly with regard to regionalism, on the role of hegemons, not only as spoilers, but also as, you know, as benevolent hegemons. And it seems to me that, particularly in your case, Ulrike, you could argue that Kenya, in a way, is acting. I'm not sure whether this is what you're saying, but it sounds a little bit that Kenya has at least the potential of acting as a hegemon in the sense of having an interest that the East African Community, succeeds and therefore is willing to take a larger share of the costs and forego some of the benefits. I don't know, but it seems to me, and if this is the case, at least it seems to me that Kenya and South Africa are playing different roles. I mean, both are sort of the regional powers in their group, within their grouping, but it plays out very differently, and that may be something to consider. And also explore the kind of theoretical implications, because, you know, the hegemonic theories, hegemonic stability theories, they essentially have no way of explaining what the preference of the hegemon are, because big states can do what they want. If they decide to act as a benign hegemon, good for the others. If they decide to act as a malign hegemon, well, too bad, right? But you have no way of saying in which they go. Small states have to suffer what they must, fine, but the big states essentially can do what they want. So, and it could well be, and then it would be still interesting to see why Kenya is sort of acting somewhat differently from South Africa or not. I just didn't get that, neither from your paper nor from Ulrike, nor from your paper, Johannes, and maybe the two of you sort of figure that out and come to a clear storyline here. In the end, I think, you know, the story about asymmetric economic interdependence, not only with regard to the EU, but also within these regional groupings, gives you a lot of explanatory mileage. There's no question about it. Whether the situational structure approach is the best way to get at this, I don't know. I'm almost done. Because Ulrike, I think, points to some other factors that go in there, and the whole issue of overlapping membership is something it's very difficult to get at with the situation structure approach. And I think that's what I learned from your paper, which is much richer on the empirics. You know, I'm not sure if you would apply your approach to Ulrike's paper, I'm not sure whether you would be able to explain the variation Ulrike has. And that is a problem, because, you know, so. And I think some part of it is that it's not the full story. I mean, it's a little bit more complex than the situation structure approach would suggest. And finally, and that will be my last word, it might be worthwhile considering other motivations for African states than economic benefits to engage in regionalism. I think we had this discussion yesterday. And one of the frustrations of the new regionalism literature with the so-called Eurocentric approaches may well be that they so much focus on the economic costs and benefits of regional integration. And in fact, if I learn something about regionalism in Africa, the economic benefits are there, but they play out very differently than sort of in the Northern Hemisphere, because there the assumption is that regionalism is essentially driven by economic interdependence among the states that form a regional group, and so the institutions help them to realize these gains, whereas given the economic structures of these countries, there is very little But there is a bit, but the situation plays out very differently. So it's mostly to attract foreign direct investments, to become more, you know, or aid with external actors. And that's, I mean, Johannes is clearly, this is why external actors are so important. But again, it's not only about the economy, it's about international legitimacy. There are issues of we talked about that yesterday, corruption and clientelism. So I think reducing it to merely the economic costs and benefits, you might lose out an important part of the story. Also with regard to the extent to which these countries are willing to engage with an economic partnership agreement, because if you just look at it, it seems totally irrational. Right? Why? I mean, or as you said, in case of Lesotho and Swaziland, they're acting against their economic interests. And I'm not sure whether you can explain this by simply focusing on the material interests of these countries. But again, I think these are great papers, and you may want to consider maybe doing something together at some point. Because on the one hand, you focus on slightly different aspects of the topic, but on the other hand, you know, you have, I think, enough theoretical mileage and empirical evidence to make interesting paper.